the way to power is organizing. We need to organize as a movement. First, we need to understand what kind of tasks exist in the right-wing movement, analyze how many people are we, what is our potential, and then we need to organize this to change the discourse, change the ideology, create a counter-elite, and then finally, we are able to also change politics.
Martin Selner is the leader of the resistance. Over a lifetime of work, Selner has emerged as the singular most effective activist in defense of European peoples. From the rooftops of Vienna, to the French Alps, to the Mediterranean Sea, Selner is the mastermind behind the generation identity model of metapolitics, involving audacious, sophisticated stunts and enormous power drops the establishment has been unable to ignore. His influence has been international. His model of agitation has been imitated by activists from Australia to Canada, and his ideas repeated by the most powerful men in the world.
Reverse migration. Boy, that was nice.
If you have no metapolitical change, becoming powerful means becoming left-wing. Because if the center of power is deep in left-wing ideological territory, to become more mainstream needs to become more left, less European, less white, less identitarian. And the only way around this is to change the mainstream itself, to make our ideas more mainstream, to be provocational. If these people think it's only about getting to the center by throwing overboard your ideas, then they get in the center, but they don't get the important idea into the center. And we want to bring the ideas in the center.
You should watch this video with full awareness of the rhetorical techniques being used. The best way to do so is by adding the parallax extension to your Chrome browser. In 10 seconds, you'll see the tricks people use to try and sway you.
Whatever, is you speak that you don't like. You'll point to things like crimes, but I mean, like, crimes are illegal. Obviously, they shouldn't be happening.
As you scan, you'll build framing scores for authors and creators and for yourself, and you'll see what techniques you're frequently exposed to. You can also ask Parallax anything you want, including the strongest version of a particular argument. Download Parallax by clicking the link in the description and enjoy telling Martin and myself why we're wrong.
Hello, and welcome to the Jolly Heretic. I have a very special guest for you today, and that is the prominent remigration activist and an ethno-nationalist, Martin Selner. Martin, hello.
Thank you very much for the invitation, and happy Easter to everybody who's watching.
Happy, yes, it's Easter Monday today as we record this. So happy Easter, everybody. Happy Easter. Jesus no se call us down, as they say in Finnish. Jesus is risen from the dead. Okay, speaking of conservative things, your book, Regime Change from the Right, has just been published in English. And I want to talk about your book. But one of the things that really struck me is that one of the things that a lot of people do that are sympathetic to your way of thinking, to ethno-nationalism and that kind of thing, is they retreat from the world. They maybe homeschool their kids, maybe find someplace out in the countryside and just try to have as little to do with the insane woke world as possible. They ride the tiger of wokeness, as it were. And you're rather critical of this perspective, I think. So why is that?
Yes, because, you know, my book is a strategical book. So first and foremost, I'm an identitarian. I think it's like the term ethno-nationalism. I wouldn't reject it. It's in the English discourse, you know, it's quite frequent. But in the Germanosphere, we would call it identitarian. It means the ethno-cultural continuity of our nation is for us the most important goal. And this book is a strategic book. So it's not so much about remigration. This was my second book. It's about the question, how do conservatives achieve power? And how can we put these ideals in place? And I wanted to start by weeding out wrong strategies and wrong approaches. And for me, this idea that is very closely linked to clean up your room, train, eat well, take your vitamins, you know, kind of, life reform. I think this is the strategic dead end because in the end, it doesn't help us to win power. And even if you move to the countryside, you create a little Noah's Ark for you and for your family, then in the end, this will not save the whole nation. And to preserve your ethno-cultural continuity, which is a collective identity, you in the end need a whole nation. So just saving your own family, saving your own DNA in a way, moving somewhere, then your offspring eventually, after a few generations, will be soaked up and eaten up by the current climate and by the foreign nation. So I think these ideas of just saving yourself and you're creating a lineage, going to the countryside, homesteading, which is very prominent in writing online discourse, I don't think it's a viable strategy to our goal.
So what do you propose then that people do instead?
I think the way to power is organizing. So what I'm doing, my theory of change, to use the terminus technicus, is Gramscianism. So the idea that politics is downstream from culture, we need to win the metapolitical war. We need to organize as a movement. So first we need to understand what kind of tasks and what kind of jobs exist in the right-wing movement. And then we can analyze how many people are we, what is our potential. And then we need to organize this to change the discourse, change the ideology, create a counter elite. And then finally, we are able to also change politics. So this is the basic idea. And my book is a take on Gramsci, but also on people like Gene Sharp, who was the father of the color revolutions. And it's a very pragmatic approach. What can we take, a very eclectic approach, what we can take from those thinkers, from these left-wing thinkers, and reapply it in a right-wing scenario?
Right, but isn't the difficulty with that is that the psychology of the left is not the same as the psychology of the right. And so when you talk about a culture, a Gramscian kind of march to the institutions, including the cultural institutions, don't you come up against the problem that it's there's a degree to which, I think you look at this in your book, actually, the right-wing people are not even that attracted to things to do with culture.
True, I agree. But I think there are psychological differences between left and right, but the technicalities of metapolitics, how to make things mainstream, how to influence the discourse, they work the same for left and right. And what a lot of people forget is the right had the metapolitical power in the 19th century, in the early 20th century. The universities were very right-wing. And in every country where you had fascist movements, the students were basically the core of this movement. And every really right-wing parties were successful first at universities. And that's why Gramsci came up with this ideology, because he said, okay, when we are rebel rousers and we organize the working class, but we don't form a counter-elite, we don't infiltrate the universities first, we will never get into political power. So this is something that a lot of people don't know, that the right had this metapolitical power. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the artists and writers in the early 20th century, you see a lot of them were right-wing. So the right was this intellectual elite, the right had the cultural hegemony, but they weren't really aware of the mechanics because they were in power. So I think this is a big problem of the right.
Well, were they? Is it quite as simple as that? Because I suppose one thing that I know about Finland. I live in Finland, but it was similar in Germany and whatever. What was promoted was a kind of peasant nationalism. And this then became, as these countries, which was a left-wing movement in many ways, a peasant nationalism, and that you idealize the peasant and the poor person as the embodiment of the genuine spirit of the nation, because the cities are polluted by foreigners. And then these places broke away, became separate nations, and then that became the elite ideology. But it was actually something that you could argue was grounded in something really rather left-wing, which is Herderian, which is promoting the peasant and the idea of particularly in Eastern Europe.
Yes, I would agree with that. So you had this national liberalism, which was a progressivist ideology throughout Europe. But when you look at it in the context from the early 20th century, and especially of Germany, of France and Italy, the conservative movement, the conservative revolution in Germany, which had no real liberal tendencies. You know, the Völkisch, you had the more Catholic, the more pagan, the more totalitarian, the more, I would say, environmentalist wings and undercurrents in this movement. But they completely dominated the universities. So I agree, maybe you have to differ from different European countries. But when you look at those the drivers of these right-wing revolutions and these right-wing movements, they were the universities. So I'm obviously not promoting National Socialism, but if you look at the genesis of this movement, it was born in the universities. when the party, like the NSDAP, had was not successful at all in the majority population. They already had the majority at almost all of the high schools. So the high schools, the universities were very right wing. It was very similar in France. And even after the Second World War in Austria, at the election, the high school elections, 33% voted for the right wing party, like the FPÖ at the high schools. So I think the right already had the cultural and the intellectual dominance. And then the left understood how important this was as a power center and completely flipped the whole thing in the 68 revolution. And then obviously with this power position, then they were completely able to reprogram everything. And it was very similar in the United States of America, but maybe this is where we are
derailing. No, I'm happy to go off to explore it. I mean, if you think, one of the things that occurs to me is, why did we flip over to being more conservative and right wing? And one idea that which we did at the beginning of the 19th century, really, you know, you have all of this left wing movements in the 18th century, French Revolution, whatever. And then there's this backlash in the 19th century, and then you get runaway conservatism culturally. And I wonder if part of the reason was lots and lots of diseases becoming endemic all at the same time. And this means that then there's a kind of a purity spiral, and you're confronted by death, which brings out sort of an instinct that we have, such as ethnocentrism and religiosity and that sort of thing, which, you know, you're confronted by death before, but now it's suddenly, boom, dead, endemic cholera, whatever, endemic tuberculosis, endemic venereal disease. And that it's that broader context that this developed out of. And then as we became less confronted by death, we just became much more just sort of decadent, really. And so actually there's a broader context to this, which is difficult to replicate, short of a massive war or something.
Definitely. I would absolutely agree. I think it's a very interesting thesis. But if you are not confronted with the reality of death, of things being timely, yes, then you're very prone to lose yourself into universalistic utopic scenarios. But what I'm describing is, when you have the cultural hegemony, when you have the electoral dominance, the cathedral, as Yavin has coined it, but it's obviously a very old term. You had Joseph de Maistre writing about it, because the French Revolution was a first sign of a different force conquering this cultural ideological hegemony. You had Antonio Gramsci, but also Louis Althusser writing about it. My thesis, when you control this, when you control the debate, the universities, then you control the media, the education, because every ground school teacher was educated at the university, every priest, every artist. So once you have this, it's like you have control over the whole bloodstream of the body. And then you basically control the whole discourse and also politics. And with this, the left has changed the Overton window, moved it so much to the left with very dedicated agenda setting, that even right-wing parties have turned left-wing. And that's something we know from all the memes, you know, that the conservatives always move to the left because mm-hmm. they reorientate themselves to the political center, which is always moving to the left. So, and that is the basic idea of our activism.
Well,
also,
I think one, you have these five moral foundations, in-group loyalty, obedience to traditional authority, sanctity versus disgust, equality and harm avoidance, and the right are about the same in all five, and the left only value two, equality and harm avoidance. So there's asymmetrical empathy. So exactly. Things are going to move to the left until you get a complete crisis. Mm-hmm. And then you and also people being confronted with, as I said earlier, death and a disease and maybe feeling that they're ostracized and powerless. And this seems to create a religious and nationalistic backlash. So is it really something you can plan, or is it just that you have to just wait for circumstances? You mentioned the National Socialists earlier. The National Socialists in Germany had the perfect set of circumstances, because you had a broadly left-wing nation, Weimar Republic, or liberal anyway. And then you have it comes on the back of the total humiliation of Germany. And then the further humiliation, because they take the French occupy the Ruhr, don't they, and things like this, like complete humiliation of Germany, and a total economic crisis in which there's enough food, and then people's sort of instincts towards nationalism are drawn out. Are you not just kind of waiting for that?
Absolutely. It's also the Russian Revolution, as Ernst Nolte has described very well in his Nexus thesis. So without the Bolshevist threat and the brutal Russian Revolution, a movement like National Socialism would have never been able to become so successful in Germany. So there were a lot of factors. But also, if you look at the Bolshevist Revolution, the question is, was it inevitable? Was it necessary? It's very complicated. I don't think you can say this in advance. You always can say it in hindsight. But I think that by understanding the mechanics of power, you can improve the chances. You can speed up the change. And there were a lot of studies about the fall of the Soviet Union. Obviously, it was inevitable. But there were certain countries where these regimes fell way quicker. And this was because the resistance was way better organized and was applying all these techniques of campaigning, of creating meta political power, of nonviolent action. So what I say is, yes, there are certain circumstances. Yes, you have to wait for the pendulum. So, for example, 10 years ago, with the best strategy, the best slogans, the best actions, you couldn't have really changed a lot because the time wasn't ripe. Now it is ripe. But still, it's very important to understand these techniques, to have a clear strategy.
Tell me about that then. So Poland was the one that went first, right? Mm-hmm. Poland was the one that toppled first.
Exactly.
You had a Polish Pope, which was just, I mean, that was just good luck. Mm-hmm. But that helped to kind of galvanize them, the Catholic element of Poland and that sort of thing. So what was it you think that was the nature of Poland was such that it was able to break away as it did? Solidarnosc or whatever in the 80s. What was it about Poland that it managed to do it first?
I think there were several factors. You said, of course, yeah, it was the metabolic effect of the Pope. Then, obviously, the Polish people are very nationalistic and they were absolute victims of the Second World War. So you couldn't also move them and control them by guilt, what you could do to a certain extent in Germany. So the Polish people had this very strong Catholic and nationalistic identity. But on the other hand, also in terms of organization, Solidarność was just very well organized. They were using avant la lettre, very modern, very progressive, very successful tactics of, for example, laughterism, like humor and street theater. One action they did is on the 1st of May, when there was this huge 1st of May parades, and all people were going out to celebrate the Soviet party, what Solidarność did was organizing mock celebrations where people would go out and put like tomato sauce in the white shirts, you know, or paint the whole faces red or paint the houses red and like throw around red tomatoes and red color to show their solidarity to the color of red and to the color of the revolutionary party, which was obviously to mock the celebrations of the 1st of May, but which was also very hard to persecute because how can you persecute people if they are, enthusiastically celebrating this party festival. So they had a set of very good tactics. They were very well organized. And that's why they were able to act way quicker and way more effectively when the time came.
So you're saying, I quite like that idea, a use of humor.
Yeah.
A better use of humor. But then how do you get over? There's a number of problems, I think, that those on the right have. The first is that it's still considered to be a kind of low status belief. A lot of people, you're dealing with the people at the fringes who are mentally unstable and insecure, and they deal with it by telling themselves. Like you even see it now with working class English people. I matter and I'm important and I'm successful in life because I have the opinions that people that are important have. And the opinions that people that are important have is multiculturalism, isn't diversity wonderful? You know, you'll get a state agents and God knows what that'll come out with this nonsense.
It's a question of status.
Yeah, they deal with their insecurities about how well they're doing in life by imitating the trickle effect, imitating those that are higher up the hierarchy. And this includes with regard to these luxury beliefs that actually negatively affect them. And at the moment, you have this association between right-wing beliefs and low status, and they trot it out again and again and again. Thugs, far right thugs, and there probably is some truth in that. So how do you get round that?
I think you're very right. That's a very problematic effect, also it's kind of a spin wheel effect, because if you promote this idea, then people get attracted. If you promote it's a thuggerish idea, then thugs get attracted to it. Then the cliche becomes a reality, and then it gets harder and harder to get people there. And obviously, people who are loose, who are intelligent, who are wealthy, who are very talented, don't go to these circles then, because they cannot make a career. So you also, after a few generations, have a biological effect, kind of a genetic effect, where those people who go to these lost ideologies and these lost causes very often are strange people, are people who have nothing to lose, people who are very often not the most well-looking or the most intelligent. So that's a negative effect. I agree with that. But I think this is also changing. And how can you speed up the change is by becoming very aware of your message control. So as a right-wing movement, that's also something I write about in my book. Every message that you put out, every person you put in the front, every banner you create, every flag you have to create has to be beautiful, because we want to attract beautiful and successful people. And this is something you have to do very deliberately. And you can do it within your scope of your resources, of your money, and a very important thing is very often it's better to do something not instead of doing it badly. So
right. If
you do something that's ugly or not well made and create a 20th small party in front of a made up strange flag with a not very well fitting suit, that's not really helping the cause. On the contrary, same with demonstrations. If you don't have a mass of people to show on the street, a demonstration is a contrary effect, because it shows how weak you are and how few people associate with the cause. Plus, your demonstration is full of weirdos. So you always have weirdos in fringe causes, but they mustn't be the majority. They have to be mellowed out a bit with a majority of people who take part in that. So you have to deliberately show signs that and actions and graphics that look very professional. You have to put in front of you people who really educate and can express themselves. And that's something we try to do. I wouldn't say we achieved with it all the time. We try to do it with generational identity. A very professional outlook, a very professional image. Read a few actions, but they have to be top-notch quality. And with this, then you attract intelligent people. And then you can fake it till you make it, so to say.
Right. Now, that's an interesting one, fake it till you make it. Because the thing is that what you often get in a movement, in these movements, is that the pool of people that are prepared to be involved is so small. And also you'll get people who are overtly quite interesting and intelligent, but then as you get to know them, you realize that they've got a bit of a screw loose. For example, there was a guy that was very active in German politics, or German sort of whatever, AfD, that sort of thing. And I won't mention it, I knew him personally, and I thought he was a bit unstable. And now he advertises himself online as, you know, I will cure you of the far right. I will help you. You know who I'm talking about. I will help you to get out of the far right.
I know who you're talking about.
I remember meeting. I met this guy a number of times, and I said to other people, "This guy is unstable. This is not a good person to have around." And people said to me, "Yeah, but he's enthusiastic and he's hardworking, and you know we've got to take what we can get." And then, of course, he was in the newspapers or whatever, and he had a complete mental collapse. And as unstable people do, he then adopted the opposite sense of identity from the identity that he had when he had the collapse. And it seems to me that you get a lot of people like that in these circles, unstable people, women who are used to be in the far left, but now I'm based and whatever. We're like, well, okay, well, what that's telling me is you've had a conversion experience, essentially. Putting aside any religious beliefs you might have about those things, I would say, as a rule, they are associated with instability. And there's so many people like that. What would you do?
True. No, before we go to what do you do, I think it's very important to talk a bit and go a bit deeper into the question, why do we attract these people? I think this is because, like, how the media reports about the right wing, and also because of the role that the right wing ideology has taken in the modern world. So we live in a completely disenchanted world. It's very rationalized, but there's this ideology of guilt and of pure evil, which is obviously the right wing and German history. And this is the only thing that really has some kind of moral, one might even say saintly, like sacred quality. It's the last sign of the sacred in an otherwise totally profane world is being a right winger. So it's a satanic energy. And if you associate it with this being a right winger, and especially with like very hardcore, very extreme idols, slogans, terms, then you immediately boost your own identity. Your identity gets hypercharged. Suddenly you are super interesting. A lot of people are interested in you. You are dangerous. If you put these patches on your shirt, then suddenly you have an aura, you have an energy. You're like channeling a real, it's kind of real magical. You're channeling a huge energy. Whole school talks about you and you get the scent of attention. And this is a designer drug for exactly those people who have an unstable and problems with their identity, you know, searching for something. But of course, there are other people who are really idealists who say, okay, all these negative side effects, but still I want to stand for the truth. So this right-wing ideology, this right-wing subcurrent attracts the craziest people and the most idealistic people, the very best of a generation and the very worst of a generation at the same time. And I think everybody who has been in right-wing circles, conferences, groups, can really agree to that you meet amazing people, but you meet also very, very bad, very crazy people. And I think that's the, so that's the analysis, what to do, what is to be done. You have to weed out people. Obviously, it doesn't work all the time, as in the mentioned case, but for example, in Generation Identity, in our movement, and this person wasn't part of our movement, so we have a very strict process here. We weed out and we reject more than 50% of people who want to become part of the movement. So we're very selective because we understand non quod sed quares, as you say in Latin. It's not about the quantity, it's about the quality. And only with the quality, you can project the right image, you have the right message control, and then you can become really big and attract exactly those people, those resources that you need for political change.
But then on the other hand, there's an element to which people that are charismatic and inspire people tend to have those kinds of...
Are you ready for the future of the West?
Thank you for listening. If you'd like to hear the full thing, as well as help with my other projects, then please become a subscriber at jollyheretic.com.